This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, Mira Honeycutt speaks to winemakers Edgar Torres and Enrique Torres about their journey to making Spanish wines in Paso Robles.
We were a cellar rat when I started my journey. I had the opportunity to meet the popular producers of Paso Robles. They gave me the opportunity to go harvest, bottle, and learn under them.
Then, my conversation with Sky McLennan about the San Luis Obispo Film Festival and why they chose DJ Ahmed to open the festival.
It left this great message that there's hope still there. Pursue art, which is the core of what the festival's about.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, April 7th, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with poetry. April is National Poetry Month, and we invited Caleb Nichols, the Poet Laureate of San Luis Obispo County, to gather local poets from the region to do a poetry session at our studio. Caleb hosts the segment. Have a listen.
Hello. Today we're here to celebrate National Poetry Month. I'm joined in the studios at KCBX by eight poets from all over SLO County who will each read us one of their poems. These poems represent a wide range of lyric styles and themes, just as the poets in our county come from a diverse range of backgrounds, identities, and life experiences. What these poets have in common is a love of language and a dedication to poetry as an art form, and an idea that poetry matters, that our experiences matter, and that our rendering of those experiences in poetry, whether on the page or spoken out loud, matters. Another way to say something matters is to say it has matter. That is, that the words spoken in these poems, like anything else in our cosmos, have weight and mass and have the power to influence or change the world, perhaps in unknown or curious ways. Poems matter, but their mattering is often a mystery.
My name is Nathan, and this is my poem called Classical. Classical record on the other room's record player, with bells to ring over a bathtub, floating big, dead bells. My first poem was a tape I found under my sister's bed, box of magnetic tapes, writing, silence. I spoke into the microphone like the child I was. The poem answered. Decades later, listen, what lost?
My name is Alexis, but I go by Complexity, and my poem is called Garden of Natives. Sit with our mother. Observe your surroundings. See vines, various colors of green, that wrap around structures, entwining themselves into each other for the strength to hold their own weight. Look out of the gazebo. See raised flower beds. These flowers are beautiful, but they are not native. Less adaptable, demanding intense maintenance, toxic pesticides in walls being the only thing to keep nature from infiltrating. Notice how the water is artificial, controlled by a source, with the power to be shut off at a moment's notice. Still, gaze farther, past the shrouded walls of the garden and into the land of limitless growth, of irrepressible trees that have stood the test of time, where native plants, easily misperceived as weeds, considered invasive, have been uprooted for their resilience, plucked into conservatories to be preserved, excavated but not forgotten, ones unrecognized for their nativity, though they lay the foundation of the land we all live on, the life source for our ancestors, who used these herbs to heal before there was artificial medicine prescribed as a cure. Help find peace for the native plants that have paved over gravel to make way for a new Eden which tries to erase their existence. Suffocated by waiting, they grow through the cracks anyway, resisting the toxins, reclaiming the land that was once theirs, with the power of those who withstand the illusion. Recognize the true needs of the land bestowed upon us by Mother Earth, devoted to those that ground themselves. Follow the roots, tap into the source. They try to bury them, forgetting they are seeds.
My name is Juan Pablo Luzuriaga, and this poem is called Parrot Talk. I am a dog sitting in a house in front of the ocean. I am a dog sitting in a house in front of the ocean. I am a seagull, and I drink coffee without shoes. I want people to think I live here, so I crap on the roof. What is that like? People pass by and nod. The voice box in my brain says that my skin is too brown to be wealthy believable. Who said that? A drunken parrot. My abuela says you gotta give them aguardientes so they talk faster. Last call, please. I can read minds. They say things like, he's the gardener or the help, but I don't have a crystal ball to verify. Shut up, parrot. The problem isn't only that I don't look the part. I just don't feel the part. I'm not the part. I'm no part. I'm invisible, hiding in the shadows of undocumented fears, not knowing the law, keeping it quiet, head down, tight leash, dangling poop bags and colorful bow ties to look less threatening. I still carry the fear parrot. Still getting paid scraps under the table, still landscaping the new roof, still picking up inside the chimney, still pressure washing decaying plaque, still digging for golden chains. I take the dogs out. Are those your dogs or are you the dog walker? I fluff my feathers and say, I am a dog trainer. Like when I check avocados at Whole Foods and say, no, I don't work here. I walk away and yell at the parrot wannabe peacock and poop in the corner of the boardwalk. He's a weird one. I sit on the curb next to the gutter. Now you're home, says this parrot. Quick. Someone shut this damn bird.
Hi, my name is Kevin Clark, and this poem is called When Trout Vanished from the Lake, Harry Said. When trout vanished from the lake, Harry said, sickness was loosed on the land. Was that code for coming ruin, or was he in a pissed sweat? He knew. The lake's a sump. Just no way words save us from what's in deep. We lugged the weight to the truck, wrapped in carpet and plastic. The corpse sky coughed methane breath at us. Our burden drew so many screaming ticks that Harry barked, we gotta shoot the pus out of the thing again. The big tires moaned their chant all the way to the site. The road carved into bone, ancient ciphers groaning their mute alarm. Soon the asphalt furrowed into a dead end. When we braked, the gate bled feral vines. Harry slid his tongue from his head.
My name is Leslie St. John, and this poem is Driving Home Between Two Mountains. The first star in a recent sundown sky is the pinprick blotch of my mother's stroke. I study the MRI, make the neurologist explain the words global, endocarditis, brain bleeds, and repeat them back like memorizing directions that will take us somewhere safe. I examine the white exploding star in my mother's brain that swallowed her speech. My lifeline across 2,000 miles, the southern song of my name in her mouth, two syllables slowly descending stairs to meet me. My mother's voice, the first ohm as I floated in her dark womb, myself only a pinprick of white light. At 44, I am 8 fat states away from her small hands and milky blue eyes. I steer the car between two mountains, black shadows rising to meet a silver moon. Single star, maybe a planet, perched there, longer than our lifetimes. Where will she go after? What loneliness is coming for me? I break for the black outside my window, and review my memory of the MRI. First splinter star in a darkening sky. Crystals of my mother's continuous strokes, just hanging in space. blotting what was once clear and awake.
If you're just joining us, I'm Caleb Nichols, Poet Laureate of San Luis Obispo County, here with poets from the Central Coast who are reading their original work in celebration of National Poetry Month.
My name is Catherine DeLancelotti, and I'll be reading Find Me. It begins with an epigraph by Onitsara. A voiceless flower speaks to the obedient in listening ear. Find me on my back, watching sky through castor leaves in spring, in Shadow Canyon, the atmospheric rivers bomb cyclones have left, the tiger swallowtail appeared. Find me in the swimming hole, ice cold. Watch my nipples erect. Watch me dip my face in holy waters. Watch a woman's head go under. Find me soaking sunlight in my mouth. Watch me watch my lover aroused. Watch the peacock, the cows, elk in the middle of the road. Find me naked in the canyon. Find it clearing out the old. Watch the live oak fall on the Tacoma. Feel my heart, hold me river, guide me, find me in the orchard eating golden delicious. Watch me birth in groundwater spread open. Watch a face appear as I scream. Find me righteous pain, piercing joy, my daughter at my tit. The storms are over. California is still in drought. Find me in the garden eating radish, praising dirt. Find me voiceless in the river, lupin, my listening ear.
My name is Jeannie Greensfelder, and I'm reading Time Travel. My 10-year-old self climbs into her time machine, aims for age 24, and overshoots the mark. In the ballpark still, but landing with me, age 80, she pouts, wants to play Monopoly and eat Twinkies. She hates maintenance, floss, water pick, and brush. Wonders why she aches and can't sleep. Where are the parties and dances she'd imagined? Her prince turns out to be an ancient king. She rails against kale and cauliflower, longs for grilled cheese, pot roast, and potatoes, convinces me to buy Coke and Cheetos, bake chocolate chip cookies. I try to reform her, yet yield a bit too happily. Though hooked on my iPhone, she wants the time machine to send her home to Mom, Dad, and mean big sister. She stares in disbelief, a disbelief I share when I tell her she's lived 80 years, that life is the time machine.
Our next poet is me, Caleb Nichols. I'm reading Magic Feather. Looking out through tule, mustard, and wild radish towards the ocean, I heard the familiar call of red-winged blackbirds, remembered how I used to find their feathers in the grass behind Shirley and Nick's house, how I'd stick one up my nose and flap my arms, thinking if I found the right feather, I'd fly into the gray sky like Dumbo. It never worked, though every day we tried, beneath the trilling wires, Grandma and me flapping our wings, not quite lifting off the ground. My car flew into this small bird as I sped down the road towards her house a year after she died to clip lilies before escrow closed. I forgot about that bird until later, when perched on the hood of the car, meditating on birdsong, I looked down and saw its wing. I found a plastic bag in the trunk, used it as a mitt, pulled it methodically, like removing a tick from a dog, ripped its wings off and nearly its head, shuddered, and just left it there, wingless, dead. The scent of eucalyptus leaves, of salt and sometimes sulfur, bay mud, eelgrass underfoot on the path to where her ashes are buried, a place she once stood in June gloom. Remember, we ran, swung from ropes tied to the branches of a Monterey cypress, foghorn sounding off away as the summer I learned to swim, the summer I found a deer skull in the woods above the house that have since become more houses. 100-acre wood, we called it. What's inheritance? A place I've accepted as home because she called it hers. What's resurrection, elegy, memory? She had a way of raising the dead, a knack for litigating the past, for turning over stones in her solitude, and this she passed on too. Thank you. And now I conjure her any old time, like it or not. Now that she's lifted off the ground, she's lighter than a feather, something I can pick up and dream into a wing.
My name is Jad Josie. I'm reading my poem, On Cooking Mushrooms. Blue oyster mushrooms into a hot, dry pan until they give up their water, until I make them give it up. Outside, the new hour is breaking, light lingering longer than the day before. My children have hung blankets against this trespass, late winter or early spring sun drowning the room. We are all drowning, but not in the bad way. My daughter says that my cologne smells good. I used to tuck her and her twin sister against my neck for hours while they slept, the scent of their soft heads forever in my nose. The mushrooms have given up their water, waiting for the fat, the salt. I am unbroken halite, but cracked all over. I am the one who decides when the pan is ready for butter. I have only just begun. I step outside to collect the gloaming. The mushrooms can cook unwatched for a while, long enough for the lingering. I have often wished for somebody, somebody with whom to share them. I am that body now, that fruiting body immaculate. My other twin asks, how do you know when they've given up their water? Watch for the weeping, I say. Watch for the weeping and do what you can to be there when it comes. We have known each other for the always and still the learning. Everything is new when you love it most. I shepherd the mushrooms into a shallow bowl, tomorrow's breakfast half prepared. There will be quinoa, roasted beets, kale, hemp seeds. The earth has turned past the sun, dark purple, nearly done blooming. You smell good, my other twin says, like lamplight or something glowing in the dark. I turn starward with my tears.
We just had the pleasure of listening to poets from the Central Coast reading their poems in recognition of National Poetry Month, being celebrated through the month of April. I'm Caleb Nichols, Poet Laureate of San Luis Obispo County, and this is Issues and Ideas.
This is KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Meher Ali. Next is Wine Country with Mira Honeycutt, who is talking Spanish wines with Paso Robles winemakers Edgar Torres and Enrique Torres.
I'm Mira Honeycutt, wine editor at Paso Robles Press Magazine and Central Coast Living, and this is Wine Country. Here, I'll bring you stories from the Central Coast wine region through my conversations with local vintners and winemakers. Paso Robles is known for its wide variety of wine grapes, some 60 different types grown in the region. However, the region's diversity extends from wine grape varieties to its people, embracing the growing Hispanic and other ethnic communities. In recent years, Spanish wines have gained popularity with Central Coast winemakers, especially varieties such as Tempranillo, the red wine expressing flavors of black cherry, and Albariño, the zesty white wine. Today, my guests are two successful winemakers from Paso Robles' Hispanic community, Edgar Torres, founder of Bodega de Edgar Winery, and Enrique Torres, no relation to Edgar, owner of Diablo Paso Winery. Each winemaker's story is a relentless pursuit of the American dream. Both of them honor the rich heritage of Spain and focus on Spanish wine grape varieties grown along the Central Coast. Welcome to Wine Country.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Edgar, we'll start with you. When and where did you arrive in California, and what part of Mexico from?
I came from Michoacán, Mexico, when I was 8 years old, landed in Cambridge, California, and I grew up there since I was 8 years old through high school, and then bounced back around the county through Santa Maria, Hancock College, and Cuesta College before landing myself in Paso Robles and kind of started the journey into what I'm doing now.
So Hancock College, known for viticulture.
It has developed a viticulture department. I went to play soccer. That was the whole reason. Yeah, so I played soccer at Hancock, and I would go back in the off season to Cuesta because I was putting myself through college, so I was waiting tables in Cambria and in San Simeon.
And then how did your love for wine begin from soccer?
So I was working in Cambria. We used to cater to the Hearst Castle parties, and so I got to be part of the team that would do food and wine pairings for those events with the restaurant that I worked at. And those guys saw me be a sponge, absorbing as much as they were giving me. And then they pushed me over to what was known as Villa Creek Restaurant in Paso Robles. That was my gateway to the Paso Robles community.
And then did you go to viticulture college? Did you have education, or did you learn...
I learned as a cellar rat. Yeah, pretty much. That's the term that we embrace. We were a cellar rat when I started my journey in the industry. The waiting tables at Villa Creek, I had the opportunity to meet a lot of great friends at the time that became the popular producers of Paso Robles, but they gave me the opportunity to go harvest, bottle, and learn under them.
And you knew this is what you wanted to do?
About the second season into it, I knew it was what I wanted to do. Wow. And I left school and went to do it.
Oh, you left school and you were full-time. Enrique, tell us about your journey to California and what part of Mexico you came from.
I came from a town in Guerrero, Mexico. It's called Ixtapas y Guatanejo. It's a fishing village. And I immigrated here in 2001, and I started working in the industry right away. And I just fell in love with that. You know, I started harvest as a cellar rat, as Edgar said. Martin & Warry Winery. And I worked with them for, I think, into 2010. And I just built myself from the very bottom, you know, being a cellar rat, the way to become the assistant winemaker for Martin & Warry Winery.
Is that what you wanted to do when you, did you come to Paso Robles?
I immigrated in 2001, like I say. I did not know what I want to do, so I was 22 years old. And it just happened that it was right before harvest, and I started working, and I'm like, this is something cool, you know. So I start asking the winemaker questions, you know, like, why are we doing this? Why are we adding nutrients, yeast, and stuff like that? And
so that was your education, question and answers.
A lot of questions, yes, more than answers. But I got a lot of good answers, too, yeah.
Well, that's the way to learn, right?
It is. I love it, yeah. I mean, college is amazing, too, but I didn't have the choice. I had to work.
Yes. So, Edgar, tell us about your winery, Bodega de Edgar. When did you establish that? You were working for other wineries. When did you decide you want to open your own wine or establish it?
I fell in love with winemaking early on in like the early 2000s. And then it was just the right time, the right place with the right people. I had the opportunity to use a ton and a half of Denner Vineyard Grenache in 2005 as an experiment. And that accumulated to 4 little barrels. And from the beginning, I fell in love with Grenache, but I was looking at down the road at what I wanted to do, and my last name was already taken in the industry as the biggest name in Spain. So I decided to at least coin Grenache into Garnacha, the name that is referred to in Spain. And those 4 barrels were treated kind of like the old world, more light, restrained style, something almost like a Pinot-like, where I bottled it a year after aging in barrel for a year. I made enough money out of that. Then in 2007, I sat down and I kind of scripted out becoming a Spanish-focused project in Paso Robles. But it definitely has morphed from being 100% varietals to now blending similar to my favorite regions of Spain.
And when was Bodega de Edgar established? When was your first vintage?
The first harvest was 2007.
2007?
Yeah.
And you do have a second label, too?
Well, I think it's part of my Hispanic culture of having three jobs growing up. I have three brands. I have Songs Wines, which is the way I wish I would have started my journey, with my respect to the producers I worked along with. I didn't want to do the same varieties that they were working and focused on.
Which is what?
So now I'm doing three Rhones, Grenache, Quérignon, and Syrah. Then I do 100% Merlot, Cab Sauv, and Cab Franc under that. And so those are the main focus varietals, 100% varietal and site-specific expressions, where Bodega is primarily blends, except for the 100% Albariño and the Tempranillos.
So you have two labels, not three. Didn't you have a third one?
Yeah, so I have something that I call Straight Out of Paso, which is paying my respect to the varieties that started Paso Robles,
such as
Zinfandel, and Cabernet Sauvignon, which I think they're the more accessible varietals that are accessible for being overgrown in the area and price point-wise to make a more accessible price point.
You've covered everything. You covered paying homage to Paso Robles,
yep.
Bordeaux varieties, and Rhones, and Spanish.
Yep. I just fell in love with this, so I just can't help myself by wanting to do it all, basically.
So what's the total production between all the three labels?
Currently, the last two vintages, due to droughts and my personal resources, I ended up back under about 4,000 cases. We'll probably grow in the next couple of years, but we're trying to finish the journey of getting into our final resting home.
What's your goal?
I'm going to probably build in the next year the forever home scene for one of the brands. And so yeah, I mean, there's a lot more coming.
So the production is at Bodega, the Edgar Winery?
Yeah. Okay. So we have two taste rooms, Songs Wines up on Peachy Canyon across the street from Law. That's where you can visit that. And then Bodega de Edgar's out on the east side of Paso off of 46.
Enrique, your downtown Diablo Paso tasting room, I know for a fact,
yes,
is a hub for locals and visitors. So tell us about your Spanish-focused wines and your different labels, and you also have a day job.
I do have a day job. I'm the current winemaker at Cali Paso Winery, which is the current Martin & Winery facility. So I used to work there during Martin & Winery. Then now it's called Cali Paso, which is owned by a Chinese family. So I'm their head winemaker right now. And I had Diablo Paso, obviously, as my baby, I say. It's, with that, Diablo Paso, we established in 2012, and I specialize in pure Spanish varieties with Diablo Paso. So I do have a second label that is called Max and Nico after my two boys. And with that label, I do pretty much anything but not Spanish varieties. I mean, I do Cab, Nebbiolo, Malbec, all kind of stuff.
What's your total production between Diablo Paso and Max and Nico?
Right now, we're about 3,000 cases probably total. Yeah, between 3,000. Mostly, I would say 20% is Max and Nico, and the rest is all Diablo Paso. Yeah.
So tell us some of the wines you produce under Diablo Paso. They're not all Spanish-focused. You do others as well.
Well, for Diablo Paso, like I said, the label, my specialty is the Spanish varieties. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of Rioja-style wines. Tempranillo is one of my favorite varieties to play with, and it's also my favorite variety to drink.
Yeah.
I love Edgar Tempranillo. It's amazing.
Yeah. So for listeners who are not familiar with the wine culture, tell us about Tempranillo, let's say as a red wine, if you compare it with another popular red wine, let's say Cabernet Sauvignon, how would you describe the different characteristics?
To me, Tempranillo, what I always say is a variety that you can make in different ways. To me, I like more like the medium body all the way to heavy body. And the beautiful part about Tempranillo, you can pair it with so many varieties of food. It's incredible, food friendly. Well, it drinks really well by itself too. I feel like that's what Tempranillo has difference from Cabernet. I mean, Cabernet drinks well with a lot of different foods too,
yeah,
but I feel like Tempranillo has that gift. You can do a cheeseburger, you can go all the way to a really nice juicy steak.
And does it show a little bit more spice character?
It usually has the leathery tobacco, you know, a little bit of that cedar. I always describe it that way, yeah.
And do you blend it with others, or do you always do a standalone Tempranillo?
I do mostly standalone, but I love to blend it with Graciano, which is another Spanish variety that grows really well in Paso Robles. I don't think there's not very much Graciano. I feel like we need more of that variety, in my opinion, because I think, like, as winemakers, we're like, okay, I take that, whatever's left, you know. I think Graciano is becoming a very well-known variety. People ask for it in the test, yeah.
Edgar, let's talk about the Albariño, the white wine. you make a good Albarino. Both of you make excellent Albarinos, and you also make a sparkling Albarino.
Yeah, so we started to flirt with the idea of making a sparkling Albarino. We released our first batch last fall, and so we left some in Tarrasch still that were aging in the bottle a little bit longer. So we'll release that later in the holidays again. But, you know, I made three Tempranillos, and I thought I wanted to approach a similar presentation to the Albarino. So we do a stainless steel fermented and aged in stainless steel Albarino that you'll see in the local areas by the glass. I make a reserve Albarino, which gets into French oak for about 7 to 9 months, depending on the vintage. And then, yeah, sparkling is the other way we want to showcase it.
For listeners who don't know what an Albarino is, explain its characteristic and, let's say, compare it with another white popular wine, let's say, like a Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying it up that easily. I think that Albarino, for me, is kind of like the crossbreed between Sauvignon Blanc and Viognier having a baby. You know, it is something that is tropical, and you get a lot of white flowers, citrusy notes that and kind of, but it wants to be a lean, crisp, acid-driven. I believe, you know, we're in the new world with young vines and stuff. The wines are a little bit more voluptuous than the old world, but we try really hard to keep the wines lean and crisp. I think that's kind of, it's more of the Mediterranean and the Atlantic coastline influenced with the food of seafood going hand in hand with it. So Albarino, it's a very fun, expressive tropical varietal.
It's getting very popular along the Central Coast because it pairs so well with the seafood bounty from Central Coast.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is Wine Country, and I'm Mira Honeycutt. My guests today are Edgar Torres, founder of Bodega de Edgar, and Enrique Torres, founder of Diablo Paso. And we're talking about Spanish wines. You're both part of a growing community of small family-owned wineries. The popular model for such winemakers who don't own vineyards is to source fruit. So in purchasing fruit, grapes, do you have long-time contracts with growers? And do you just stick to Paso AVA or source from other California appellations as well? Enrique?
My fruit usually is mostly Paso Robles. I had the pleasure to play with fruit from Napa Valley. That was a project that I did, and unfortunately I lost that contract because they plant more Cabernet, so there's no more Tempranillo there right now. But I also source from here in San Luis Obispo, which is one of my favorite ranch for Albarino. Mm-hmm. That one is one of the vineyards that was planted back in the day by Martin and Warwick. Mm-hmm. Those cuttings were brought by Alan Keeney, actually, so they planted there, and it's called Jack Ranch.
So he was the father of Albarino here, right?
Yes. I had the fortune to work for him for many years. We worked as a team. He was my boss. He was my mentor. But I get that fruit, and to me, I am a very lucky person to be able to say, I'm getting part of that fruit from my Albarino program from Jack Ranch Vineyard. And obviously, I do get a lot of my fruit, mostly Paso Robles. I'll say all my reds come from Paso Robles.
And you do your production at Cali Paso, right? Because you don't have a winery itself.
Exactly. I am an AP at Cali Paso, so I have the freedom to make my wine there, which I'm very thankful to my boss, the owners of Cali Paso, yeah.
That's very convenient.
It is very convenient, yeah.
And Edgar, your property doesn't come with vineyards, right?
No, I bought a property 3 years ago that we ripped out of the old vines in. We're going to try to get development going before we replant. But yeah, I started buying fruit from outside first, from Monterey County all the way to Santa Barbara. But in the last 5 years, I've decided to kind of make life a little more focused around Paso Robles. So about 90% of the grapes that we're working with are part of the Ducey Vineyards. So Paper Street Vineyard was an opportunity that we had to see from the ground up, picking the hillsides, rootstocks, clones, and the varieties, and how we wanted things to be farmed. And then from there, we spanned out to doing Cap Franc from Matt Ducey's house. Lago Vineyard is out on Crescent Road. It's owned by the Ducey as well. I had the opportunity to graft some Albarino there for our program as well. And then I do go into the Santa Rita Hills a little bit to buy fruit down there. And
Santa Rita Hills, but that's known for Pinot.
No, that's for Syrah.
Oh, for Syrah. You get a cool climate Syrah. From.
Yeah, and then unfortunately I walked away from Kimsey Vineyard, but I used Kimsey Vineyard in Ballard Canyon since 2011 till last year. Our dream is in the next 5 years to have a few acreage of our own. So that's the next goal.
So what would you be planting?
If we proceed forward with our property on Peachy Canyon, we're going to plant primarily five of the varieties for songs, which are Merlot, Cabernet, Sauvignon, Syrah, and most likely Grenache there. And if we can, we'll see if we have the space for a little bit of Quérignon as well. Ideally, down the road, my dream is to have my own acreage to supply about 70% of my production.
Oh, that's good. So yeah. Over the years, you will have your own fruit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the time being, we'll be partnering up with Ducey's.
Of course, but that's a good partner to have.
It's a great partner. I admire the family's legacy, so it's a privilege to work with them.
It's a historic vineyard in Paso Robles.
Yeah.
What do you think of the camaraderie between the winemakers in Paso Robles?
Paso Robles is one of the areas, in my opinion, that we are so friendly with each other. I feel like we welcome everyone, and winemakers know each other. I mean, I made several phone calls or texts or emails, so, hey, I need this, or I get the same bag, you know, and I would say, yeah, if I can help, I would definitely help. You know, there's a lot of younger ones. I'm like, man, I was in that position 20 years ago, and now it's like, I'm looking older, what's going on here? But I always willing to help if I can, you know, equipment. Usually, you know, sometimes they ask about fermentation and stuff like that. And that's the beauty about Paso Robles. Hopefully we'll keep it that way.
Edgar?
You know, I think from the day that I walked into it, everybody was very welcoming. And even to the day of my current situation, some of the friends that helped me at the beginning, being mentors and being there to advise me, are still there. And so I think Enrique and I can attest to there's a lot of young kids coming into the scene that call us and take a little bit of our time, just like we used to do it. You know, I think Paso Robles community is somewhat enviable from other regions, because we all break bread and we all help one another, and we help each other guide through sometimes circumstances of fixing fermentations to helping each other bottle, lend each other equipment and stuff like that. And it's been there since I walked into the community. It has been a very welcoming community for anybody that wants to get into it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I was speaking with Paso Robles winemaker Edgar Torres, founder of Bodega de Edgar, and Enrique Torres, founder of Diablo Paso, and we were talking about Spanish wines. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Mira Honeycutt, and this is Wine Country.
Up next, the San Luis Obispo Film Festival starts April 24th and goes on until April 29th with encore screenings from May 1st to the 5th at the Palm Theater. Sky McLennan is the executive director for both the festival and the Slow Film Center. She talks to me, Meher Ali, about what she's most excited about for this year's festival and why a theater is the best place to watch your favorite horror movies. Welcome, Sky.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So first, talk to us a little bit about the history of the film festival and also the San Luis Obispo Film Center. How are the two connected?
Yeah, so our festival's been around now. We're going into our 31st film festival. It started by a group of friends and Mary Harris, an attorney here locally. And at first it was black and white retrospective screenings, actually, and some really incredible classics, showcasing them at the Fremont and the Palm. And then as the festival started to grow, we added new independent films in the first couple of years. And that really, I think, took the festival in kind of a different direction. And now we're kind of known for those films in particular. And I would say also a lot of documentary we showcase, more than narrative films, and films from all around the world. So we've got all different kinds of topics, lots of diversity of things that you get to explore. Really trying to bring the world to San Luis Obispo. And when it comes to the Film Center, basically in July 2024, we took over the Palm Theater, which is our local indie theater here in SLO, and brought it under a nonprofit. And we were doing that to really ensure that this place that people know and love can continue for many, many years to come. And I like to say we were bringing the film festival to a year-round space all year long. So even since last July, we've had all kinds of Q&As and events and just really activating the space for film lovers alike. and then the festival pops up as well. So that's just now the festival is just one thing of many things we do all year long.
I love that. Just hearing about like space for film lovers. Like, mm-hmm. I think every town needs one just to complete the idea of being a town. It's like there's a library, there's a bookstore, there's a theater that everybody goes to.
Yeah. I was talking to someone recently, like that was a condition in them moving here because they were moving from a big city which had a little local art house indie theater. And they're like, if I can't move here, if that doesn't exist in this community. And it was interesting to me because sometimes I think people take it for granted that we even have a space like this in our community, and not every town has one. And it's something people seek out.
How old is the Palm again?
It was built in the late 80s, and Jim D, who's the owner of the building who we rent from, he actually had a theater before that called The Rainbow, which was also in downtown SLO. But yeah, it's an older building, though. It actually was an employment office before it ever was a movie theater.
Wow.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. That was really interesting bit of history about our town. So you're the executive director of the festival. Tell us about your journey and how you ended up organizing and heading an entire film festival.
It's kind of crazy, actually. I grew up here locally in Templeton, and I wanted to be a filmmaker. And I actually said to myself that I would never come back to this area. And I moved away. I lived in San Francisco, and I also lived in Australia for a long time. And throughout that journey, I was working at film festivals. I got involved as a volunteer and then slowly became a staff member. And I just fell in love with the opportunity that and platform it gave to filmmakers, the diversity of films that were being showcased. And it's just like a really, there's this kind of magical, synergistic, like, feeling, you buzz that you get. Because it's more than we're just showing movies. You know, we have Q&As and panels, and people are really connecting with the films in a different way. And I fell in love with it. And I happened to move back home. And I met Wendy, who was running the film festival at the time. And she's like, I'm looking to step back. And we started like the transition process. So it was a huge leap for me. I was working in teams also at major film festivals. The Sydney Film Festival is huge. And, you know, has like a staff of like 30 or 40. And we have a staff of like 2 or 3 full-time staff. Mm-hmm. So it was like a huge transition. We're just doing it.
I love the trailer for DJ Ahmed.
Mm-hmm.
That film is selected to open the festival.
Yeah.
And then Daryl Hannah's documentary called Coastal, which is on Neil Young's solo tour, is the closing night selection.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose these two? What's special about each of them?
Well, it's funny. It just kind of was random that they both happened to be about music. I think right now, you know, it's a bit of a heavy time. People are feeling a lot of things. They're feeling, like there's just a lot going on, I think, in politics and our lives and money and all of that. And we were very conscious about that when we're programming. And you can see that in the films. A lot of the films that we got were really heavy. But as audience members, we don't necessarily, I don't know, I think we are looking for a little bit of an escape, or we're looking, I think, for a sense of hope. DJ Ahmed is a really beautiful story because it is about a boy, a kind of classic coming-of-age tale, who's living in a very religious community, who is different, who wants to be a DJ. And he's like fighting against that. And I just felt like it left this really great message that, like, yeah, there's hope still there, and that, you know, pursue your dreams, pursue art, which is kind of the core of what the festival's about too. So it was a great way, I think, to kick things off. And then to close, Coastal is a really intimate look at Neil Young through the eyes of Daryl Hannah, his partner, following him on this tour that he did, which was kind of coming out of the pandemic. And so I think he was a little apprehensive at the time. It's just very raw and real. And, he's just such a poetic singer, and you just kind of spend time with him. I knew he's a huge part of this community. People love him here. And so it felt like the perfect fit for SLO.
Can you talk about some Central Coast-focused events, such as the Central Coast Filmmaker Showcase and Coastal Awakening?
Every Monday of the festival, we have a Central Coast Filmmaker Day where we really turn the lens on the people making films here locally. And so throughout the day, you'll see films from these like incredible filmmakers throughout Santa Barbara, Monterey, and San Luis Obispo County. And then we also have the Coastal Awakening series, which is always like it kind of changes each year, but it's an organization here in SLO that's really trying to kind of, I don't know how to describe it, like expand thought and curiosity and art. And this year they focused it on David Lynch, who's personally one of my favorite filmmakers, and really exploring the idea of meditation and David Lynch, which he was very passionate about meditation. And we're actually going to show this documentary about meditation. It's a free event. We're not allowed to charge for the screening. And yeah, we have some really exciting things planned. We have Bob Roth, I believe, coming, who's the head of the David Lynch Foundation and does transcendental meditation, which if you know Lynch, that's like his thing. Like he just really gets into it. And that's a big reason he attributes to his process and how he makes his film. So it'll be really a great tribute to him. And then we also have Jay Duplass, who is the brother of Mark Duplass. And he's an incredible actor, producer, director, writer. And his new film, The Baltimoreans, just premiered at South by Southwest. We're showing that. And we're giving him the Spotlight Award. And I just think he's such an incredible talent. Both of them are. I grew up with their films. In the indie film world, they're like, yeah, kind of like the kings. So it's really exciting that he's going to be here. And the movie is just so heartfelt and raw and real. And it's not a huge budget or anything. And it really, I think, tells this narrative that, you know, you don't need all this, all the bells and whistles. If you have a good story to tell, that's kind of what shines through. What else? All kinds of things. Surf Night is kind of one of our staple events where we bring the latest in surfing films. We have three films this year. We also are bringing back Skate Night, Community of Skate, this incredible film about this pro skateboarder, Leandre Sanders. They call him the Skate Goat. That's his like coined term. Yeah. And it's a story about his life. Actually, the filmmaker Van started following him at 12 years old, actually, at the Venice Skate Park. And he went through a lot of ups and downs. And you see that in the film and him just kind of overcoming all that adversity. And yeah, it's just an incredible movie. He's going to be here, which is really cool. We also have some other pro skaters coming. So I think that's going to be really special, even if you don't like skateboarding. So yeah.
Where can people buy tickets for the events?
All of our info is at slowfilmfest.org. And the full program is live right now, so you can see everything. A little over 100 films. We have documentaries, narratives, shorts, music videos. You name it, we have it, probably.
You have a fantastic lineup. It is so comprehensive, and there's something for everyone. I'm a horror buff, and I'm really excited about the Red Eye shorts. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think something that we've found in the exhibition space is actually horror and genre is bringing people out to the theater because it is fun to experience that with an audience, right? I think you saw that in even Demi Moore's The Substance. Like that film was just so, we showed it at the theater. It was just so fun to watch that with a crowd. And so the last couple of years, we've been trying to grow that area, the genre part of the festival. We've shown a couple of feature films, but this year's our first year doing the shorts. And it's because we keep getting horror shorts submitted to us. And we really feel like we want them to feel like there's a home for them here at the festival. And the quality of them has just been incredible. So This year, the horror shorts, I think we have one that's a little like psychological thriller. We have a slasher one that's also kind of a social commentary. We've got a really funny one. So I feel like we've crossed all the genres in a really nice way. And then we also have another film called The Ugly Stepsister. If you like The Substance and you're into body horror, then you'll love that movie. That's a feature film. And so, yeah, we want to continue to do that. I think horror gets a bad rap. We have some friends locally, the Micro Horror Group. They put on a DIY horror film festival every October, and they're little shorts, like five minutes or less. They're incredible, and people in the community make them. I think there's so much you can say. If you really think about what horror is, it's kind of what our fears are as humans. And so, yeah, there's so many layers to it and nuances. And as a fan, you probably see that. I think on the output, everyone's like, oh, blood and scary and all that. But there's so much more if you really, like, dive into it.
I could do, like, another talk with you about that.
Yeah.
I don't think that I have the time. But,
yeah,
I think horror is, like, I feel comforted by horror. Like, I don't know if that's weird, but I do.
Yeah.
Like, and I love horror that is like social commentary on it. Like,
yeah.
And that has been like on the rise. I mean, I'm really happy to see like His House is one that comes to mind. But
Yeah.
I don't want to go there because then I won't shut up about it.
I think, too, horror has been – there's been a lot more freedom to really experiment. And that's been cool to see an indie film. And then you can do it with a lot less money. So like Terrifier 3, for instance, they made that for very little money, but it killed at the box office. And literally. And so like, yeah, I think it's just as worthy when we're talking about independent film, like horror definitely needs to be included because it really is a huge part of that space.
Yeah, and I haven't seen The Substance, but I'm so happy that it was nominated.
Oh, yeah. It's very unique and special. I mean, there wasn't anything like it. So, yeah, it was exciting to see.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Meher Ali, talking to Sky McLennan, Executive Director of the San Luis Obispo Film Festival. The festival is happening this month from April 24th to the 29th at movie theaters in downtown SLO. You can buy tickets at their website, slowfilmfest.org. I wanted to actually ask you about how you involved local nonprofits like Race Matters. What was the intention behind that?
I think the intention was, you know, getting different perspectives and kind of programming that other people want, and also being able to highlight certain issues. So we started the program with Race Matters, I think, 4 or 5 years ago now. And essentially, they curate and select all the shorts that get shown. And it's a great way for them to talk about the great work that they do and then showcase voices that maybe are underrepresented as well. We've really made an effort across the entire festival to do that now. But it's also just kind of like giving an opportunity for other people to have space within the program. And it's not just like, it's just all us kind of thing. So because a lot of the films we show, a lot of the documentaries have a lot of, I think you come from them and be like, what can I do? Or like it highlights some issue or something. It just makes sense to partner with a nonprofit that's doing the work here locally. And then they either intro the film or do a Q&A, and then they can really speak to that. And you can have that moment or feel like, okay, I can actually make this change in my own community. So we work a lot with like Lumina Alliance, for instance. And we're working also with eco-logistics regarding the environment this year. So it's a really big thing that I care about as well, personally. I'm a big supporter of collaboration. I think it's crucial into your survival as an organization and as a nonprofit. We have hundreds of nonprofits here in SLO, and we're a small community. And so, yeah, I really believe in working with each other and uplifting each other's work.
So take us behind the scenes. How long did it take to plan this festival? And then also, what were some of the challenges that you faced?
So we basically start planning the film festival as soon as the other festival ends. So the festival end, we take about a month off, and then submissions open in July, and we start planning for next year. So a lot of people think it's like all thrown together, but it's almost a little under a year process. And yeah, it takes a lot of time. Once we get the submissions, we have a little over 70 screeners that watch all those submissions, and then they kind of curate the top, and then we kind of come in and review those. We look at where the gaps are, what are the topics that we're wanting to cover, and then all the other pieces start to fall into place. I think budget is probably one of the hugest things. We're definitely growing, the festival's growing, but we're always struggling financially to get sponsors and support there, sell tickets. I think that's a big factor in it. And also staff and bandwidth and burnout. I think those are big things. Festivals in general, music festivals, all those kinds of things are really time consuming, and it's kind of a weird job in the sense of there's just periods of time where you are just slammed. And so you go from being so busy to not being busy, and it's hard. It's a lifestyle that I've done for a long time now, but yeah, you get burnout from it. And finding people that are willing to come in on a temporary basis for a couple months here and there, I think that's always a challenge because people are looking for more like a full-time position. Yeah, we just are trying to keep up with that growth. And now with the Film Center too, this year is our first year doing both, and that has been like a lot. So yeah, but we're just take it day by day.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
Just that I think it's such an incredible event. We have typically between 60 to 70 filmmakers coming here to SLO from all around the world. I actually thought this year that some of our international films, I'm like, oh, they're not going to travel, and like with everything going on. But I think we have people coming from the UK and France and Canada. So they're going to be here. And I would love for the community to show up and support these filmmakers. They're incredible and talented, and they're just so eager to spend time here in SLO and connect with audiences and really hear your feedback and your stories. That's really what makes it special. So yeah, just come. Like you said, there's really something for everyone. We've put a lot of effort in curating a selection of films that kind of meet those needs.
Thank you so much, Skye, for being here. It was great talking to you.
Thanks.
That was Skye McLennan, Executive Director of the San Luis Obispo Film Festival, talking to me about this year's lineup. The festival starts April 24th and ends on April 29th. You can buy tickets at slowfilmfest.org. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. Follow us on Instagram at KCBXFM. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.